The doubts about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were becoming harder to suppress, not only outside the administration, but also inside it. Yet many of us, including the president, were anxiously, in hindsight wishfully, clinging to the false hope that in due time, the U.S.-led inspection team, with its large staff and vast resources, would discover Saddam's weapons, the weapons we knew he must have, hidden in bunkers or buried under Iraq's desert sands. The intelligence could not have been so far off the mark. Saddam had to be hiding at least some WMD somewhere in Iraq. Anything would do. This wishful thinking was why the president jumped the gun and declared that we had found the weapons in the form of two mobile biological weapons labs, only for our intelligence to conclude later that they weren't weapons labs at all. My own doubts had begun to grow a little more acute a couple of weeks before I took center stage in the briefing room. I well remember a turning point in my own psychological evolution, a moment when the tables were turned and a press secretary received a valuable insight from a reporter. One day, Ann Compton, a respected veteran Washington correspondent now covering the White House for ABC News Radio, popped her head inside the office I occupied as deputy press secretary, located directly behind the podium of the press briefing room and just down a hallway ramp from the press secretary's office. Because the lower press office was conveniently connected to the briefing room and its adjoining booth where beat reporters worked, they would frequently drop in on me and my fellow deputy Claire Buchan for comment or information. The official press areas, an upstairs space where the small offices provided for the network correspondents and wire reporters were packed with 2 to 4 journalists each during the working day, a basement area where cable, radio, and other print journalists were housed, and the down-at-the-heels briefing room itself, it hadn't been remodeled in years, where camera crews and sound people working for the networks usually hung out, were cramped and not as private, so my office was a better place to talk. I was always happy to speak with Ann. She seemed to thoroughly enjoy being a reporter. She'd been a member of the press pool on 9/11 and had provided on-the-spot reporting about the president's day between his departure from Sarasota, Florida, on Air Force One, and his return to Washington that evening. On this late June day, Ann had come to ask me something about the war in Iraq, which was in its third month. With major combat operations declared over, coalition forces appeared to be engaged in mopping up operations after a quick and easy victory over the armies of Saddam Hussein. But the dictator himself remained at large. Unguarded caches of weapons and ammunition had been looted in the aftermath of the invasion, and the American military was beginning to notice a disturbing uptick in the number of attacks being mounted by a growing Iraqi insurgency, particularly in the known area as the Sunni Triangle. Unalloyed optimism, even glee, over our swift conquest was beginning to give way to concern about the long-term prospects for Iraq. When the conversation veered into the issue of WMD, I repeated the White House's standard position at the time, which I shared. We believe that weapons of mass destruction will eventually be found. The inspectors are still in the early stages of their work. Ann's response was blunt. In a matter-of-fact tone, she declared, "They're not going to find any weapons. If there were any, they would have found them by now." She spoke with an air of confidence as someone who had worked in Washington long enough to anticipate a story's likely end. I was a bit shaken for a moment, but as Ann left my office, the sense of hard-nosed reality she brought with her departed as well. I quickly found myself repeating in my head yet again the logical arguments we'd been making for days about why Saddam's WMD surely existed, even though they were difficult to find. Arguments about his history of owning and using them, about his record of deceiving and outwitting UN inspectors, about the solid judgment of intelligence analysts, not only in our own intelligence community, but among our allies as well. The weapons inspection team, known as the Iraq Survey Group, and headed by David Kay, we reminded ourselves, was still scouring through miles of Iraqi government documents, translating them from Arabic, and searching the more barren parts of the country, following leads on underground bunkers and possible burial sites for the elusive weapons. Saddam was a deceitful, defiant ruler who had played rope-a-dope in the desert with inspectors over the years. For all those reasons, we still suspected the weapons existed. These were the same arguments some of us would continue to make for several more months, though we would eventually start emphasizing weapons of mass destruction programs over weapons of mass destruction, even as more and more people outside the White House bubble came to believe that the primary justification for the invasion had been badly off the mark. But deep inside, Ann Compton's words haunted me. They were on my mind as I visited with Karen Hughes, the president's former counselor, in my new office on day one of my stint as White House press secretary. I had run into Karen shortly after my first briefing in my new role. I caught some of the briefing, she remarked with a smile. How'd it feel? I thought it went fairly smoothly, all things considered, I replied. We were already embroiled in the 16 words controversy about the president's State of the Union claim, later determined to be unfounded, that Iraq had tried to obtain nuclear materials from Africa. Under the circumstances, with the White House press corps increasingly emboldened to challenge the White House, I knew there would not be much of a honeymoon period for the new press secretary. But the assembled reporters had gone somewhat easy on me on my first day on the job. They knew they'd have plenty of opportunity to verbally swing away at me in the months to come. You look pretty comfortable at the podium, Karen replied. Thanks, I said. We haven't had a chance to talk in a while. If you have a minute, I'd be interested in visiting with you and getting your thoughts about the job. Sure, I can come down to your office in a little while, she said. Karen had left her position as counselor to the president just over a year earlier, in June 2002, having wearied of the countless hours in the White House and longing to spend more time with her husband and teenage son, Robert. She still served as a part-time advisor to the president, Dan Bartlett, her successor, and other senior White House staff, visiting Washington every few weeks to participate in big-picture strategy discussions. With the president moving into re-election mode, we'd be seeing more of her. We sat down at the small round conference table in my office, near the fireplace. Outside the window was the entryway at the end of the driveway to the main entrance of the West Wing, where a Marine often stood guard in dress blues. Four 13-inch TV screens flickered silently on one wall, typically set to the three cable news stations and C-SPAN, except on some working weekends when Texas Longhorn Sports on ESPN or one of the networks would get a little playing time. Against another wall stood a comfortable couch underneath large photographs of the president, one of him visiting troops, another at the ceremony commemorating the first anniversary of 9/11, and a third enjoying a laugh with his father the first time they stepped foot in the Oval together as president and former president on Inauguration Day 2001. Karen got straight to her most important advice. It was about credibility. Your most important job, in my view, will be to make sure the president maintains his credibility with the American people, she said. It's one of his greatest strengths. People trust him. His honest and trustworthy numbers and polls have always been very high. She went on to say, I think you have a real opportunity to be a very effective press secretary. The press likes you. They know they can trust you. If you handle the job the way you're capable of, you can go down as another Mike McCurry. This was a very gratifying and bipartisan bit of flattery. Mike McCurry had been Bill Clinton's longest-serving press secretary. What's more, he had managed to build and sustain a strong personal reputation based on his own credibility among White House reporters and in Washington circles, despite serving at a time when the president's personal approval and own reputation for integrity was plummeting due to revelations about his private peccadilloes. But my gratitude for Karen's words was tempered by concern. I couldn't forget Ann Compton's comments from a couple of weeks before. Nothing had happened in the interim to improve matters. As it became increasingly clear that our chief rationale for justifying military action in Iraq might well be entirely wrong, I knew it would be increasingly difficult to diminish the corresponding tension and contentiousness of the briefing room. The 16 words controversy was an early indication, and it was still underway. I'd begun catching myself thinking, a bit ruefully, that Ari got out just in the nick of time, even lightheartedly teasing him about it. You picked a good time to leave, I said. Disaster was not imminent. In the short term, most members of the public would take the rising level of attacks on the president with a big grain of salt. An election was on the horizon, and voters understood that the rhetoric would be heating up. When voters perceive attacks as partisan mudslinging, they tend not to be influenced by them, reserving judgment until the criticisms are proved to be valid. And many Americans who'd begun to accept the notion that WMD might not be found in Iraq were remaining steadfast in their support of the war, at least for now. Saddam fooled Bush, they shrugged. So what? He fooled everybody else, too. That doesn't change the fact that he was a brutal thug and a dictator. Good riddance to him. But the factors that worked to our advantage in the short term were also working against us in the long term. The buoyant opinion polls clouded our judgment. We assumed that public patience with the president and the war would be sustained as we continued to show forward progress toward a democratic Iraq. the gradual but consistent increase in the number of American troops killed or wounded would prove us wrong. Having gotten this far by vigorously seeking to manipulate public approval to our advantage, most notably in our political propaganda campaign to sell the war, we assumed the same approach would continue to work in our favor and help us overcome any challenges ahead. And having turned away from an open and forthright approach in the build-up to war, whether consciously or not, it would become increasingly difficult as we entered the re-election campaign to alter that course we had set. The biggest mistake I made as press secretary was in failing to challenge this kind of ingrained thinking within the Bush White House. But in retrospect, it would have been exceedingly difficult for me to do so. The cards I had to play were dealt even before I accepted the job, meaning that the unsatisfactory outcome of my years as press secretary may have been preordained the moment I stepped to the podium for the first time that morning in July. Whatever the full dynamic behind the insular, secretive, combative nature of the Bush White House, it was well established by the time I was asked to become press secretary. I could see that it was unlikely to change in any significant way during my tenure, especially with the re-election campaign already taking shape. This was not a time when anyone was looking to change the way things were done. In the end, I decided to accept the job because of my affection for the president, commitment to public service, and my realization that this was the opportunity of a lifetime. Having resigned myself to accepting the restrictions and difficulties that went with the job of press secretary in the Bush White House, I suspected that there might be a price to pay. While I didn't know exactly what it would be, I didn't expect it to be too severe, nor did I anticipate how painful some of the lessons learned in my new job would turn out to be.